This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
What began in Minneapolis is now a global movement for racial equality. In Spain, the anger and frustration are nothing new.
They don't treat me like a regular person. As a black person here in Spain, you're always being watched. And all we ask for is respect and equality.
As Europeans rally to condemn racism in America, people of color revive an old phrase to respond to hate, a way to confront Europe's colonial history of racism and its legacy today.
When people would say, you know, go back to where you came from, and the phrase was, but we are here because you were there.
Also ahead, international agents raid a drug lab hidden in the jungles of Southeast Asia and make the biggest meth seizure ever.
Yeah, when they put it on display for everybody to see, it was like a football field practically of chemicals and equipment.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Good to be back with you. Change is hard, so it's remarkable how fast things have changed across the globe since the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis. Even a word central to this moment is being changed, something that rarely ever happens. Merriam-Webster will be updating the definition of the word racism. The new definition will include how uneven access to power is part of the problem. Throughout the hour today, we'll be checking in on global movements to end systemic discrimination. We go first to Toronto, where that city's first black police chief has resigned. The World's Rupa Shenoy has our story.
It came out of nowhere.
So here I am after 37 plus years of serving what I believe to be the greatest law enforcement agency in the world.
With just 8 months to go in his term as chief of the Toronto Police Service, Mark Saunders seems to have surprised everyone by abruptly resigning without fully explaining why. He's had some health issues, including a kidney transplant, but he said that's not why he's leaving.
Family is the most important thing to me right now, and sorry if anyone is shocked in a bad way, but there are a whole host of reasons. And at the end of the day, it's a whole bunch of things, but it's going to be good to be dad.
Reporters kept asking, why now? But Saunders refused to say more. Akwasi Owusu-Bempa studies policing as an assistant professor at the University of Toronto.
Mark Saunders himself probably feels that he doesn't necessarily want to engage in another round of conversation and potential reform, and that it may be better left to someone else who would have a longer time left at the service.
Saunders was born in England to Jamaican parents who moved the family to Canada when he was a child. He was appointed chief by the Toronto Police Services Board in 2015. Owusu-Bempa says Saunders' main competitor for the position back then was also black, and that candidate was seen as more progressive, with more ties to black communities. In contrast, Owusu-Bempa says Saunders was seen as more of a cop's cop, overseeing the homicide and guns and gangs task force units.
The board went with Saunders, which signaled to many people in the community that they were going with an enforcement-oriented officer as opposed to a progressive community-oriented officer.
That choice was reflected in what people in highly policed neighborhoods experienced. Sam Tekle is a community worker in Toronto's Jane and Finch neighborhood. He says they've fought to keep police out of their area.
I have young people that I work with who tell me they have to think about which way they go to school or to walk with a girl or a young lady so that they know that they're less likely to hit a checkpoint, which means to encounter police.
There have been several high-profile incidents of Black Canadians being racially profiled and assaulted by police. In 2018, the Ontario Human Rights Commission found that while Black people were just 9% of Toronto's population, they made up 70% of those who died in police shootings. Tekle says Saunders helped maintain the status quo.
So very much he provides a certain kind of cover for those who believe that representation represents change. It becomes much more difficult to get certain calls to be made on the behalf of Black and racialized and Indigenous folks, because so often the retort is that there's a Black police chief.
But after George Floyd's death, Saunders declared that incremental change was no longer enough.
All right, guys, we're going to take a knee.
He kneeled with protesters in the street. And by stepping away from his position, Tekle says Saunders has left an opening for possible change.
It is a moment of possibility. This is the beginning, I think, on towards thinking that policing may not be an institution to which we should continue to invest if Black lives really do matter, as so many of our corporations and our colleagues at work and our bus drivers and our city councilors have proclaimed on social media.
The protesters have already won some change. Earlier this week, Toronto's mayor committed to putting body cameras on all officers, maybe even by this summer. And some city councilors have taken up protesters' calls to defund the police. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
Authorities in Asia have just pulled off what the United Nations calls one of the most successful counter-narcotics operations ever. It happened in the remote hills of Myanmar. The police are celebrating, of course, but the story behind this operation is messy. It involves the Chinese mafia, even Donald Trump. The World's Patrick Nguyen has our story.
Usually when cops seize a lot of drugs, they like to pile them up on a table for the cameras. But for this bust, they needed a field for the photo op.
Yeah, when they put it on display for everybody to see, it was like a football field practically of chemicals and equipment.
That's Jeremy Douglas. He's the head of the UN's Office on Drugs and Crime in Southeast Asia. This bust turned up mountains of meth, 18 tons. Douglas says that's the most seized ever. And chemicals to make drugs, too. Metal drums, plastic barrels, lined up as far as you can see. Also, gleaming lab equipment, these big stainless steel tanks.
We're looking at sophisticated reactor vessels, sophisticated glassware. They're like mini factories that we would see in an industrial park.
Only these super labs were in the jungle in northern Myanmar, close to the border with China. They mostly produced meth, but police also turned up something else. It's a liquid form of fentanyl called methylfentanyl, a supercharged version. 200 to 300 times stronger than heroin. Douglas says that should concern people from here in Asia all the way to the United States.
That's where fentanyl has its foothold. So potentially it could be going there.
There's a lot to untangle with this story. So let's back up. Who is the mastermind behind these drug labs? Well, this gets awkward because the labs were protected by a local militia, one that technically works for the Army of Myanmar. Yes, the very same army that busted the labs. And it seems the militia had cut a deal, saying, hey, we'll protect this area, and since your army budgets are tight, we'll do it for free.
Since the military cannot afford to feed, arm, and equip them, they have to work it out by themselves.
That's Khun Sai Jai-yin. He used to be the secretary for a man named Khun Sa. He's dead now, but when he was alive, he called himself a freedom fighter. The U.S. called him the top heroin producer in the world back in the 90s. So Khun Sai, the former secretary, he knows the global drug trade well. He says his old boss, he would also sometimes tell the army, yeah, I'll defend this area for free. I asked Khun Sai, why would any militia do that?
As long as they are against the government's insurgents, government's opponents, the government just give them a free hand to engage in all sorts of activities.
Activities such as producing drugs, he says. But these militias, they don't know chemistry or how to make meth or heroin or fentanyl, so they have to invite outside mafia, always from China, Khun Sai says, to come and set up the labs and then traffic the drugs on the global market.
Investors would come and set up refineries in his areas because it was safe, from disturbance.
That is, safe from army and police disturbance. The super labs that just got busted, no one touched them for ages, and the cops knew they were there. So why were they raided now? It may be that this militia started selling meth to a rebel group in Myanmar that is currently giving the National Army hell. That is a video posted by that rebel group. Khun Sai says, if you do business with guys like that, the army will instantly cancel any protection deal it might have with you.
If you are working for the military, you can do anything. But if you are working for the military's enemies, then it'll be something else.
Something else like you get busted, and all your fancy lab equipment is piled up in a field for the cameras. Now, back to that methylfentanyl. The army seized a whole lot of it from the militia. Picture about 25 bathtubs full, enough to get millions of people high. Jeremy Douglas from the UN says this is big time.
So it could be cut into the heroin market to mix it into that heroin, make it more powerful, because a little bit of this goes a very long way.
Usually, fentanyl gets made in some factory in China and then shipped straight to the U.S. Donald Trump has made a big deal out of this, declaring war on the drug and its suppliers.
And I want to win this battle. I don't want to leave at the end of 7 years and have this problem. Okay? I don't want that, right?
Trump has told China that his trade deals hinge on Beijing shutting down the fentanyl pipeline into America. And in the last 2 years, Beijing has cracked down. But that may be pushing the fentanyl trade into a more lawless place, like the hills of Myanmar. And in Myanmar's drug trade, the goal is always to get product out to a wealthier country. Take meth, for example. Douglas says a kilo of meth from a lab in Myanmar sells for about $5,000.
But by the time it gets to Sydney, Australia, or Tokyo, it will be worth, you know, well over $200,000, $250,000, $300,000 for that kilo.
Now, the real dream market for fentanyl is the United States. It has the biggest appetite for opioids by far. Myanmar's drug lords have pulled this off before, only with heroin, in the 80s and 90s, during the heyday of Khun Sa. Now, this recent fentanyl bust, this is what happens to product seized by authorities in Myanmar. They burn it. We may never know where it was headed. It's hard to say for sure it would have ended up in the U.S. But Jeremy Douglas at the U.N. says that would make a lot of sense. And if that started happening in a big way, it could be a really big deal. The U.S. has brought its war on drugs to Myanmar before by going after the heroin kingpin, Khun Sa. A former DEA chief, Thomas Constantine, once said this about him.
He has delivered as much evil to this world as any mafia don has ever done in our history.
They even tried to kill him, hoping it would collapse the whole market. But that didn't work. Khun Sa retired comfortably, living under the protection of Myanmar's army. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
Here's a milestone. Britain has gone 2 months without burning a single lump of coal for electricity. The UK has been moving away from the dirty fuel for a decade, but it's the pandemic that brought about this new record. Lockdown sent the demand for electricity in Britain plummeting earlier this year, so the national utility temporarily shut down the country's few remaining coal-fired power plants. Fatih Birol, head of the International Energy Agency, says that's been happening around the world.
In terms of coal, the decline in consumption is the largest since the Second World War.
Just a decade ago, about 40% of the UK's electricity came from coal, but the country has shifted to renewable energy as part of its strategy to combat climate change. Here's former Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn addressing Parliament last year.
We are living in a climate crisis that will spiral dangerously out of control unless we take rapid and dramatic action now.
The country's biggest power plant now burns wood pellets instead of coal, and the world's largest wind farm was completed off the coast of Yorkshire last year. Energy Minister Kwasi Kwarteng hopes the UK will be able to repurpose old coal mines to eventually add geothermal to its energy mix.
Obviously, we have this huge historic legacy in terms of coal, and I think being able to use that footprint and turn it into geothermal energy, I think that's incredibly positive.
No matter what happens to energy demand during the pandemic, coal is not long for Britain. Its last coal-fired power plant will close for good in 2025. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. With some pretty blunt language today, China dismissed an idea that came from the U.S. Secretary of State. Beijing said that Mike Pompeo's views are, quote, narrow-minded and ridiculous. Why'd they say that? Pompeo had criticized the global banking corporation, HSBC, because HSBC came out in support of China's controversial new national security law for Hong Kong. The proposed legislation bans a list of things, including separatism, subversion, and any behavior that gravely threatens national security. Beijing said that Hong Kong business leaders are making what it calls an objective and fair evaluation of the proposed legislation. A spokeswoman from China's foreign ministry also warned the United States today to stop spreading dissent and stirring up trouble. Meanwhile, in Hong Kong, protesters were back in the streets. On Tuesday night, police arrested several dozen people. And today, Hong Kong's Secretary of Education sent a letter to administrators at primary and secondary schools. It said that students should not go to demonstrations, chant slogans, or hold hands in human chains as a form of protest. By mid-April, China was recovering from the coronavirus. Lockdowns were lifting. But then a new worry, fears of imported cases, people bringing back coronavirus after traveling abroad. In the southern city of Guangzhou, there were rumors that two Nigerian COVID-19 patients were spreading the virus. That fueled a wave of anti-foreigner sentiment across China, where black people of many nationalities were targeted. Among them, two African-American women. They had moved to China for better career opportunities and a better standard of living. The World's Rebecca Canther met with the two women. They asked that we only identify them by their initials to avoid any potential problems with their residency in China.
4 years ago, JC, a teacher and poet from Mississippi, moved to China with her husband and two children on a grand adventure. Now she teaches literature to high schoolers in Guangzhou.
It was going to be an opportunity for us to, essentially experience the American dream that's easier to find in other places than it is in America.
BR, who's from Philadelphia, also found a version of that dream in Guangzhou. 6 years ago, she moved to the city for a short-term teaching job and wound up staying. She built up her own educational consulting business and brought over her 9-year-old nephew, who she takes care of.
You know, my contract was for a year at that time. I said, you know, you can do a year. And then I changed so much and I didn't want to go back home. I was just thinking that there was nothing in America for me.
BR and JC say there's another thing China offers.
I do feel safer outside of the U.S. than I do at home. I feel safer in China because no matter what anybody thinks, Beck, at the end of the day, they can't shoot me for it. And I can't say that for living in the U.S.
China has its own brand of racism, one that's mixed with waves of anti-foreigner nationalism. Chinese people sometimes stare at JC and BR on the streets or move away from them on the subway. When the pandemic hit, fear of the virus made things much worse.
Outrage trails viral video showing Nigerians being forced out of their homes and their passports seized by security personnel in China.
Black people were targeted, no matter their nationality. They were refused taxi rides, banned from supermarkets, forced to quarantine in their homes or hospital isolation rooms, or even sleep on the streets after being kicked out of their apartments. JC and her family stayed indoors to keep safe.
It was scary here for a while. People made it very clear that they were fearful of us and didn't want us around. People were being harassed and people were being turned away at restaurants, or people would go to restaurants and everybody would get up and leave, and, you know, just very dehumanizing thing.
Around this time, BR saw a viral video shot at a McDonald's where she'd sometimes go to eat. An employee was holding up a sign that said in English, "No black people allowed." BR sent the video to a Chinese client she was friendly with.
What she said was, "Why are you always upset about these things?" At that point, I just felt like I didn't have like an ally.
One day, BR and other foreign teachers were blocked from leaving the campus where they were working and living.
And the guard just like held his hand up. Stop. No, you can't pass. Even with all of my whatever documents the university said I needed to leave, I just couldn't do it.
She was stuck on campus for weeks until the guards finally let her out. What she found surprised her.
Like, I went out and people were nice to me and I was like, wow, this is amazing. So now when I go out, like if I go out to walk the dog, like the workers and everyone, they're like smiling and coming over to talk to me, where before they were like running away from me.
The change started happening in response to outrage from African governments. provincial officials issued a statement saying that businesses should treat all people equally, and they set up a hotline for foreigners. For example, if someone called the hotline to complain they'd been turned away from a store, authorities would show up to resolve the problem.
That only needed to happen for about a week before people started to chill. And that's why, you know, you start serving some consequences and this stuff stops.
Of course, discrimination hasn't really stopped in Guangzhou, a city of 13 million people. But what BR found most disturbing was that people could change so abruptly in how they treated her, shunning her one day and welcoming her the next.
I feel like I'm in the twilight zone. Like, I don't know who I'm going to face or what mood they're going to be in that day based on what's going on.
Now, as protests in the U.S. are being broadcast around the world, BR and JC are watching closely. So are the Chinese people around them. After what BR went through, she doesn't feel comfortable talking about what's going on in the U.S. JC and her students, on the other hand, are talking openly about the protests.
I've definitely been grieving. On the verge of tears, not being able to sleep is hard. But my goodness, I have drawn so much energy from my students. And the outpouring of love that I got from those students was tremendous.
She feels some guilt that she's not in the U.S., where she'd be protesting. But she's found a sense of purpose in China.
I have to remind myself that, you know, there's pain all over the world. There's misunderstanding all over the world. There's racism all over the world. Wherever you are, you can do work towards that because it's everywhere.
For BR, the past few months have changed everything. Now she's trying to figure out where she and her nephew can go next.
We feel like we don't have a home. Here, it's not that comfortable right now, or maybe it hasn't been for a while. And then also, like, we can't really call America home anymore either. So it's just like, where do you go?
For the world, this is Rebecca Canther in Shanghai.
You join us here every day because you know you'll get stories that expand your thinking about people and places around the world. The stories that really stick with you, take a moment to share them. We're on Twitter, @TheWorld. That's where you'll find the stories you hear on the show and our journalists who report them. We are @TheWorld. Winter 1986, Prime Minister Olof Palme of Sweden is walking home from the movies when he's assassinated in the street. Despite many witnesses, the shooter flees the scene and the crime goes unsolved for decades until now. A Swedish murder mystery is solved 34 years later. I'm Marco Werman. That story coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH and PRX. In India, population 1.3 billion, cases of the coronavirus are spiking. Mumbai, the financial hub, now has 51,000 recorded cases. That's more than Wuhan, China at its peak earlier this year. And yet, restaurants, stores and places of worship are reopening across India. It's been 2.5 months, this entrepreneur in Delhi told the BBC. People need to go outside and go back to work. Pramar Mukherjee is a professor at the University of Michigan. She's been modeling the outbreak of coronavirus in India since March.
It is actually a steady growth, and I do not see the curve turning the corner. According to our models, by July 1, there will be around 600,000 to 2.1 million cases, potentially. That's the upper bound of the confidence interval. So things are not looking to come down very soon in India.
2.1 million potential cases. That's stunning. I mean, so when do you expect a peak?
The models show that the peaks are not until late July and August, but I would really caution you that as the models project out into the long-term future, there's tremendous uncertainty associated with these projections because we really do not know what people are going to do on the ground as the country reopens. Is there going to be a cautious return or a very vigorous return that people have fed up with the lockdown?
So just to be clear, you would still consider that peak the first wave, right?
Yeah, so India, it's definitely not the second wave. But if you look at India, I think it's very important to recognize the statewide heterogeneity. So some of the states have actually experienced their first peak. And if you look at their virus curve, it looks like other places in Europe where the lockdown came within 3 weeks, you saw a slowdown of the cases and the curve went down. But that has not been true in most of India's states, for example, Maharashtra, Delhi, now Tamil Nadu, Rajasthan, Gujarat, and Uttar Pradesh.
Yeah, so given that variety, it must be really difficult to create a model or different models even for a country of 1.3 billion people. So how do you go about that?
Yes, that's a great question, because I think I missed this point initially when we started to model the national data and without tracking this heterogeneity across the states. So now in our app, we do have state-specific models because there is tremendous heterogeneity in the states and even within states. India really needs to track the data at a very granular level.
So do you think, Professor, the statistics you're relying on to build these models, are they reliable? Because we've heard so much about the inaccuracy of various models because, for example, testing is so variable from country to country.
Of course, we are working with very imperfect data and imperfect reality. So the question is that we could give up and say that, no, we are going to not do any projection models because we do not believe the case counts. We do not believe the death counts. But to me, what the model does is instead of the absolute numbers, the takeaway messages and the lessons from intervention perspective is still meaningful because it helps me to study the problem in terms of really thinking about deploying resources. For example, just looking at R or doubling time does not give me any idea about how many cases do I expect in Mumbai, how should I plan my healthcare capacity. So for that, I do need the projection models. And even if they are projecting high numbers, I at least know the worst case scenario and prepare that where do I need the beds and the ventilators and the ICUs and the PPEs. So I think the models have some utility in terms of planning and policy.
Professor, you were born in India. I know you have aging parents there and deep bonds to the subcontinent. How much is the overall future health of India in all respects in the forefront of your mind as you do this work?
The work on India has meant more to me than just doing data science and modeling. My entire family is in India, and they are in Calcutta, which was hit by a Category 4 cyclone in addition to the coronavirus. So how do you do social distancing in a natural disaster? All of these hard questions that you have to ask. And that is why we are very worried about coronavirus in India, because India has about 0.7 beds per 1,000 people. Very few ICU beds and number of ventilators are also limited. So I think India has a fragile healthcare system.
Pramar Mukherjee is a professor at the University of Michigan who's been modeling the outbreak of coronavirus in India. Professor, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Our other top story today takes us to Spain, where memorials for George Floyd have been held across the country. Floyd's death has sparked a national conversation in Spain about the oppression people of color faced over the years there, being targeted by police and made invisible in Spanish society. Jennifer Omani has our story from Madrid.
The memorial for George Floyd in Madrid was originally planned for 200 people. In the end, 3,000 showed up in front of the US embassy.
Es ilegal, ninguna persona. Es ilegal, ninguna persona. Es ilegal.
Shannon Evora López Rodríguez was born in Madrid to parents from the West African nations of Guinea-Bissau and Cape Verde. For this restaurant manager, something as simple as playing soccer in the park could end in a confrontation with the police.
We were doing nothing out of the ordinary, but they stopped us and asked us for ID. I got so angry in that moment that I didn't want to hand them over because I did not understand why I had to.
One survey by the University of Valencia in Spain found that black people were 7 times more likely to be stopped by the police than white people. In 2018, the United Nations found that Spain had major gaps between law and practice in protecting people of African descent from racism, and that racial profiling of people of African descent was endemic. As the protesters pointed out, this racial profiling has cost lives. While Spain does not have the same record as the United States for police killings, those attending the George Floyd Memorial also recalled the death in 2018 of Mamey Mbaye, a Senegalese man who suffered a heart attack after being chased by police through the streets of Madrid. Flava Mendy is a computer science student. He was also born in Madrid to parents of African descent. He says walking alone, any time of day, can mean a humiliating stop and frisk by the police. As a black Spaniard, he has never felt treated equally to a white Spanish person.
O sea, a mí no me están dando un trato como persona. Tú aquí en España como negro, te van a, estás en el punto de mira siempre.
They don't treat me like a regular person. As a black person here in Spain, you're always being watched. We're speaking the same language and looking at each other with the same eyes, and we bleed the same way, and all we ask for is respect and equality.
There are no official figures that track the number of Spaniards of African descent, but there are 1.2 million people living in Spain who hold an African nationality. Regardless of the numbers, Spaniards of African descent have almost no representation in political and cultural institutions outside of soccer teams. Spain's first black lawmaker was elected in 2015, and only two more have followed since. Moja Jaró is a journalist and anti-racism activist. He says black people in Spain are typically excluded from the housing market and face racist insults at soccer games. Spain's school curriculum erases black contributions to history, while university students are overwhelmingly white.
Bueno, yo creo que lo que une a Estados Unidos y España.
I think that what the United States and Spain have in common is structural racism. And I think the important thing to signal from that point in common is how black people are viewed as criminals, as people constantly under suspicion of having committed crimes. When you go to view a house and they won't rent it to you because you're black, in the end, it's the same story, whether you are in Minnesota or Madrid.
Spain's geographical proximity to Africa has formed a fundamental part of its history, Moja Jaró points out. But he says Spain continues to deny its long-standing connection to the continent.
Africa está literalmente a 14 kilómetros de España.
Africa is literally 14 kilometers away from Spain's coast. So I think that black people, Moroccan people, and Africans in general have always been here. What happens is that they have always been excluded from society and excluded from places of visibility and power.
Born in Huesca, a provincial Spanish city, Moja Jaró says he has never shaken what he calls the immigrant condition.
La condición de inmigrante.
The immigrant condition never leaves you, ever. It doesn't matter if you were born here, you will always be someone foreign.
And while anti-racist slogans are part of left-wing politics in Spain, Moja Jaró says that the current progressive government is not prioritizing the dismantling of systems widely viewed as racist. His own experiences in the world of journalism reflect an influential club largely closed to people of color.
There are no more than 10 black journalists in Spain, and that's a problem because it doesn't reflect the reality of the streets. And above all, it doesn't take into account a racial perspective when stories are made, beyond us as victims, always dying or suffering or as the bad guys. Beyond that, we don't exist as experts in anything else, like the economy or politics, or to talk about coronavirus in Spain.
Spaniards came to the American embassy to publicly commemorate George Floyd's life, and also to say, Black Lives Matter here, too. For the world, Jennifer Omani in Madrid.
Sometimes the truth is stranger than fiction. On a winter night in 1986, the Prime Minister of Sweden, Olof Palme, was walking home from a movie theater in Stockholm with his wife and son. Then he was shot point blank and killed on a busy street with numerous witnesses. The shooter fled the scene. The murder remained unsolved for decades. Today, prosecutors announced they were closing the case. They identified the killer as a former graphic designer named Stig Engström, who died in 2000. That news probably does not come as a surprise to our next guest. Mattias Jorgensen is the editor of Filter magazine in Sweden. In 2018, they published a lengthy investigation into the murder and pointed to Engström as the likely killer. Jorgensen joins us from Stockholm. So, Mattias, take us back to 2018. What led you and Filter to look at Engström?
There have been so many leads during, you know, all those years. Fantastic leads. It has been a Kurdish terrorist organization. It has been, you know, Western Germans. The police themselves maybe killed Palme. Maybe CIA killed Palme, and so on and so on. But Engström, he's concrete, and you can prove that he was on the crime scene. But there was no one who said anything that matched his story after the shots were fired. And every time someone had found this, because some people had done this before, some other reporters and some other, even, you know, normal people had scanned the documents and found that, that this piece of the puzzle doesn't fit.
So in 2018, you realized that the case and the investigation up to that point basically had been really kind of, I don't know what the word is. Was it shoddy? And you just decided we've got to kind of pull all the evidence back.
You know, it was shocking because they have formally dismissed him on faulty grounds. And that means they had spent more than 30 years of investigating anything but the killer. And that was, of course, shocking and it was very strange.
This case, the assassination of Olof Palme, the prime minister, has had a huge cultural impact on Sweden over several decades now. I mean, there have been conspiracy theories and legions of private detectives chasing down their leads, countless books and movies. I mean, it's kind of like Sweden's own JFK assassination. What has this case meant to Swedes?
It's the Swedish trauma. It's the murder of Olof Palme. In a way, it wasn't just the person who died. It was also the belief that Sweden was safe, secure. You know, he didn't have bodyguards. He went to the movies that night. He took the subway train. You know, he was an ordinary guy. And Swedes thought it should be like that and that it could be like that forever. And when he was, you know, killed, they said it was the end of Swedish innocence. And I think that is not an exaggeration, but the truth.
In terms of the legal process, Matthias, what will happen next year? I mean, Engström died in 2000. So what are the options for Sweden's justice system?
They just closed the investigation today. There will be, you know, no more actions at all.
Will today's announcement provide any closure to people in Sweden? Will there continue to be speculation and conspiracy theories?
I met one of Olof Palme's sons, Morten, in a radio studio just, you know, 40 minutes ago. And to me, it was very satisfying and important to hear him say that for him, this is a closure, you know. He and his brother, they are satisfied. And for them, this is the end of this. And I think that is most important, that the family feels that this is enough. But of course, there will always be a lot of people. You mentioned JFK, right? You know, it will go on forever.
Matthias Jorgensen, the editor of Filter magazine in Sweden, he's been speaking with us about the case of the assassination of Prime Minister Olof Palme. Case now closed. Matthias, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
Large crowds have taken to the streets of capitals across Europe over the past week to express their outrage at the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis. The protests have been loud. Others not so loud. That's the moment a statue of 18th century slave owner Robert Milligan was taken off its pedestal in London. The Guardian newspaper captured that moment. London's Mayor Sadiq Khan says the city's landmarks, including street names and plaques, would be reviewed by a commission to remove any tributes to slavery. George Floyd's death sparked this movement across Europe to confront its own colonial past and current problems with racism. Coming to grips with all of that will be a challenging process for many Europeans. That's what I heard from London-based author Gary Young.
One of the differences between America and Europe is that when it comes to anti-black racism, Europe's most egregious acts took place abroad. Our civil rights movement took place abroad, our segregation, our slavery. And so our civil rights leaders, we don't have a Martin Luther King, but we do, as Britons, have a Gandhi, have a Kwame Nkrumah. Your Portugal is Amilcar Cabral and Chissano. But the fact of that distance, that arm's length, means that it hasn't been internalized in the same way. And so there is this challenge to really teach the history in order to understand the present. So a prominent activist here, Sibin Andam, had a phrase when people would say, you know, go back to where you came from. And the phrase was, but we are here because you were there. Now, of course, if you don't know that you were there and you don't know what you did there, then it's very kind of difficult to understand why people are here and why they might see history as very different to you.
So, Gary, you've written in the New York Review of Books what Black America means to Europe. And one line stood out to me. From the vantage point of a continent, i.e. Europe, that both resents and covets American power and is in no position to do anything about it, African Americans represent to many Europeans a redemptive force. Explain that.
They see in Black Americans a way of embracing America, because you're embracing that bit of America that is least co-opted, least bought into the kind of power structure, least representative of the power. Now, this is, of course, problematic, because if you take George Bush era, where American foreign policy, bombing of Iraq, axis of evil, Guantanamo Bay, American foreign policy was articulated either by Colin Powell or Condoleezza Rice. The face of American foreign policy was Black. And then you get onto Obama, who Europeans adored, and he was then the face of American power. He was the I have a drone. He was the architect of American foreign policy, which didn't change that much between George Bush and himself. So it's not that it's not problematic, but what they're trying to do is finding a way to embrace an America with which they have a deeply ambivalent and complicated relationship with. They covet its power. They resent its power. They kind of enthrall, by and large, to elements of its culture. Some elements of its culture and not others. And here stands this group, which signifies both that America is not all that it claims to be, but that America could be so much more.
So when you write that African Americans represent to many Europeans a redemptive force, is that sensation having a moment, and do you think it will be permanent?
There are severe peaks and troughs, and also moments of dissonance. And I don't think Brits understood Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice. There is a kind of infantilizing element to this, that kind of they love African Americans so long as they are playing the role that's expected of them, as opposed to being full human beings. So it's not unproblematic, but in this moment, you see a kind of America's standing has never been lower in Europe than it is now. And this particular set of rebellions and resistance, George Floyd isn't just a murder, he's a metaphor. And he's a metaphor for a lack of democracy, for a kind of race-baiting president who doesn't care about the rest of the world, doesn't care about anyone, who has a kind of deep-seated xenophobia. And so this lands in a moment where people see a huge need for redemption. And so this notion of the redemptive source takes an outsized position.
Gary, you live in London. Your parents were from the Caribbean. You experienced race as a Black man. I know you've said that you hear frequently from Europeans that when it comes to racism, it is, quote unquote, better here in Europe than in the U.S., suggesting, I don't know, degrees of racism. How do you react when you hear that?
When people say that to me, I say, well, there is no good form of racism. There is no better form of racism. I lived in America for 12 years. My wife is African American. When I came back to Britain, people said, well, that must be because the racism is so bad. And I said, do you honestly think I would come back to London to escape racism? And there is this kind of competition almost, this desire for moral superiority, having rescinded material superiority and military superiority and economic superiority to America, there would be some moral superiority, and that in some way we should be happy with the racism that we have.
Author Gary Young is a professor of sociology at Manchester University in the UK. Gary, thank you very much, as always.
Thank you.
Just picking up on what Gary Young was reflecting on there, the long story of racism in Europe and England. In 1979, around the time Young would have been about 10, a schoolteacher named Blair Peach was struck in the head at an anti-racism rally in London and died. The episode became a cultural touchstone. It emerged that Blair Peach had been killed by a unit within the London Metropolitan Police Force, known as the SPG, the Special Patrol Group, and that other officers had kept silent to obstruct the investigation into Peach's death. Here's Jamaican dub poet Linton Kwesi Johnson, always a storyteller, with his 1980 homage to Blair Peach.
Call them kill Blair Peach, the teacher. Them kill Blair Peach, the dirty bleeders. Blair Peach was an ordinary man.
Blair Peach took a simple stand against the fascists and them wicked plan. So them beat him till him life was done. And everywhere you go, it's the talk of the day. Everywhere you go, you hear people say that the special patrol, them a murderer. Murderer, we can't make them get no further out. The SPG, them a murderer. Murderer, we can't make them get no further out. Them kill Blair Peach, the teacher. Them kill Blair Peach.
Dub poet Linton Kwesi Johnson bringing us to the end of this hour of the world. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you all tomorrow.
But his memory lingers on. Oi, people of England, great injustices are committed upon this land. How long will ye permit them to carry on? Is England becoming a fascist state?
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.